So, good evening. I'm sorry that I don't speak Portuguese. I will try to speak slowly, clearly. If you don't understand, please ask. It's not very complicated what I have to say, although it's not usually what you hear. If you come to some other sort of conference, you won't hear what I will say. Although it's very ordinary, it's nothing special. You know that I am a Zen teacher, but this is about Zen, or you wouldn't be here, I think. I know that this is the 25th of April, which is a very important day for Portugal. I personally, in 1974, was quite young and was not aware of what was happening in Portugal. Was anyone here aware at the time? Do you have memories?
Yes, very much.
Yeah. And do you remember what it was like before?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Good. And there's a big difference?
Yes. A lot.
Okay. Well, Zen practice is like that. What the point, if there is a point, is it's the equivalent of after the revolution. We are trying to free ourselves from what keeps us closed in, blinded, repressed, oppressed. It's as if we were sitting in a dark room. The window, the glass was dark, and that's how we live our lives. Or as if we were living in a country under a dictatorship. When we are not free, we cannot say what we want to say, we cannot even think what we want to think. We cannot move about freely, we can't travel freely abroad. If we do, well, we leave. We're not at home in our homeland, as I understand it was like in Portugal before, something like that. This is how we generally lead our lives, more or less. Something's not right. Something, we're just a little unhappy or anxious. We want a better job. We want a different car. We think if we had different friends, maybe we would be happier. The other people seem like they know what to do, and I don't. And I'm getting old, and my leg hurts, and I'm sick, and I want to be young again. And when I'm young, I want to be old, and always something else. So it's like we don't see, it's as if we were in a dark room, we don't see what is really there. We don't see what the world really is. We don't see who we really are. We're not at home in this homeland that is us. This is the conclusion of the talk, actually, because Zen practice is about opening our eyes to that, to this. It's as if the glass becomes clear, the windows open, and we're no longer in a dark room. As we sit, because basically Zen practice is just sitting down, looking inward, looking at our self, what is inside. Not worrying so much about the other people in the room or the people next door. First, we look inside. If we are being held prisoner somewhere, we have to first free ourselves, and then we can take care of the other people. But if we're not free, we can't take care of the others. Now, how can just sitting free us? If the Portuguese people had just sat, there would have been no revolution. Something had to happen, right? Someone had to do something. That's where this practice is backwards. First, we do nothing. We just sit down and let things settle. Usually our mind is clouded over with all kinds of ideas, opinions, beliefs about ourselves. I'm not smart. I am an angry person. I am lonely. I am afraid. I am smart. I am rich. I am not rich. I am talented. I am not talented. A lot of ideas about ourselves. And then opinions about other people. Oh, she's no good. She always says bad things about other people. I don't like her. Or she always talks about herself and doesn't pay any attention to me. I don't like her. I want her to like me, and she doesn't, so I don't like her. A lot of opinions, ideas, ways of functioning. And this clouds our view. It's like if this bottle were filled with muddy water, dirty water. And usually we are like this in the world all the time. We're busy, going everywhere, getting things, throwing things away, pushing people away, grabbing people towards us. Busy, 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 busy. When we sit down in a Zen practice, this is what happens. The water becomes still. Whatever was in the water settles, and we can see it clearly. We can see the water clearly, and we can also see what was clouding the water clearly. But it's no longer clouding the water. The water doesn't change. It's still water. The container is still the container, the same. And the dirt is still the same. We didn't have to eliminate it in order to see clearly. We just had to let it settle and be in its place. This is a metaphor for ourselves as well. We don't have to change anything. We don't have to take anything out and throw it away. Just stop and sit down. Let things settle. Sounds easy. It sounds as easy as putting this down. It's not, of course, because our mind is very busy and functions in a way that it's always attracted to opposites. So if something is good, bad is always a threat. There's always the fear that bad will take away the good. Or if something is bad, we desperately want what is good to take away the bad. If something is black, well, it's not white. We think always in dualities. When in fact, those dualities exist. Absolutely. There is a man and there is a woman. That's true. But the essential nature is the same. The terms tall and short are relative, depending on the perspective. For me, a tall person is not as tall as it is for someone who is shorter than me. She will think of that person as being taller. These are all relative terms, depending on how you look at it. From the point of view that is not relative, from the what we call the absolute, just the sky, where there's nothing, everything is the same. We are all equal. Everyone has the same nature. This sounds conceptual. However, everyone, I would guess, more or less, has felt this, although you don't really think about it. Children often feel this. Children don't have great difficulty with differences. They can easily, any object can become a toy and become anything. They have no problem with seeing, freely experiencing things. Maybe we could think of it in terms of a fraction. You know how a fraction is, you have a number on top, the numerator we call it, and on the bottom, the denominator. On the top, you would have the number, you know, you would have a man, a cat, pizza, happiness, anything, a flower, any phenomenon, any feeling, whatever. The multitude of differences would be the numerator on top. On the bottom, underneath, the denominator is the common denominator. One. The lowest common denominator. One. This is a representation of reality. Usually we only function in the numerator aspect. We only see the differences. And therefore, we miss the limitlessness, the vast possibility of our lives, because we're focusing only on what limits us. We are like living under a dictatorship of differences. Only differences. And that gives us a society in which everyone wants to impose their individuality and accumulate things because it's never enough. There's always something different. Something different will satisfy me. When we open our eyes and we see the other aspect, the common denominator, we can appreciate things just for what they are. We can see the beauty in each and every person, every object, every form of nature. No more dictatorship. The differences are wonderful, and I can appreciate my own difference because I see that we are all one. We all are of the same nature. And I don't need to be any different. I don't need to be different than you because I am already. I don't need to be different than what I am. All of this sounds very conceptual, probably. And it is, because I can tell you this over and over and over. And it's as if I were pointing at something, and instead of experiencing what I was pointing at, you were staring at my finger and thinking the point was my finger. But the point is not what I'm telling you, the point is experiencing it. I'm drinking water. I'm telling you that. But I'm the only one experiencing it. You have to experience drinking water yourself. The words are helpful. It's like a recipe or a map. But you have to discover the country yourself. You have to make the food yourself and taste it yourself. Drink the water yourself. So I would like to try an actual brief meditation with you if you're interested. It will be just an introduction in order to give you a little flavor of what I'm talking about. It's the kind of thing that anyone can do anywhere at any moment. You don't need to have any special skill, special knowledge. Old, young, I teach this with 3-year-old children, old people sitting in chairs, sitting on the floor, outside, in rooms like this, in churches, in schools, anywhere. So, a few basic guidelines. Sit comfortably in the chair with your feet planted on the ground. It's important to be stable. If the body is stable, your mind has a better chance of being stable, as with the bottle. If the bottle is not stable, the water has no chance. It's moving, right? And then have your shoulders not too stiff and don't be too tense. You can just have your hands on your legs like this, nothing special. Like that is fine as well. That's the traditional position of the hands. It's not essential at this moment. Eyes open, but looking towards the ground, not staring at something, not fixing on a point, just letting your gaze rest on the floor in front of you, or if the chair or whatever is in front of you. And then take a few breaths, just feel yourself here, feel yourself on the seat firmly, feel your feet on the floor, feel your hands either on your legs or in the position. Feel your back against the chair. Physically be just very aware of your body. And then take a breath in and a breath out and think one. A breath in, a breath out, two. Breath in, a breath out, three. Breath in, out, four. In, out, five. In, out, six. In, out, seven. in, out, eight, in, out, nine, in, out, ten. And then back to zero. And you do it yourself this time. All the way to ten. If you lose track, don't worry, go back to zero. Start over again. If you get to 10, go back to zero. If you're lost and you're thinking about what you plan to do for dinner, go back to zero. Okay, let's stop. How did it go? What happened? Anyone like to say anything? Everyone did wonderfully and counted 1 through 10, no problem. And you didn't get to 10. Well, I'm not sure when I was counting out loud if I did it. Did I say all the numbers? For a minute I thought that wasn't sure. And what did you do when you didn't get to 10?
Because at 3 or 4 I was thinking of something else, and then I would come to 0.
Everyone else made it to 10 at least once? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No? Yeah, at least once? Did anyone go beyond 10?
No.
No, I say that because the first time I did this I was at 120 or something before I realized that. No. 10. This is a very basic exercise that we use to stabilize our mind. A concentration exercise. Because as we've seen, it's difficult to keep track, to stay present. Very quickly our mind is off. And sometimes our mind is so skillful that we are able to count and do the counting 1 through 10, no problem, all the while planning my vacation or going back through a long discussion that I had with a colleague 3 weeks ago or something. And maybe even several levels our mind is able to do that. Counting, reliving the conversation, and being aware that I'm reliving the conversation and counting. And then another level sometimes is being aware that I am aware of counting and reliving the conversation. Very powerful, our mind. And that's its nature. We don't have to stop it from doing any of those things. A technique like this is designed to allow the mind to do what it does, while also training ourselves to just be present, to not run away. With children, we do this. I have 2 children who are now older. My son dumped out a bottle of something and just left it and went away. You know, or he just leaves his dishes on the table, goes away. We do this with a lot of things in our life. If we're uncomfortable, we go away. Sometimes even what we really want, we go away from. We just finished a retreat, and someone said that to me. She said, I was here, I was talking to you, I felt really good, I felt really calm, I really liked it, and then I just left. I didn't ask any more questions, I just left. And I went back and sat down, and I realized, I do that in my life all the time. The things I really want and when I really feel good, and I go away. There are many reasons for this, and we won't go into that. I'm not a psychotherapist. I don't deal with that kind of thing. However, we don't have to go away from our life. We don't have to run away from good things and bad things, or bad things. This is a practice in just sitting with whatever arises. And surprisingly, by sitting with it all and letting it arise, it loses its power. It's as if you shine a light into a corner where there's a shadow. When the light is there, there is no shadow. A practice like this involves turning the light inward, shining it on whatever is there. And sometimes it's not nice that's there. Sometimes it's wonderful. We don't judge it. It's all equal. We just sit with it. And this practice of counting and drifting off and then coming back is the basic example of what life is about. Life is always moving. Life is always changing. The moment is never the same. As you see with your mind, things are going all the time. We are dying in this very moment. Our cells are being regenerated and dying every moment. The sun is setting. Tomorrow it will rise again. It's a constant movement. Life is movement. We don't like that. We want things to stay the same, because then we feel like there's no movement and it feels safe. When actually, we're just tying ourselves up. We're tying ourselves down. If we go with the movement, which is means just not hanging on to whatever arises, just letting it be, then we're free. We're truly free. And this practice, what we just did, is the basic practice of life. And the moment when we recognize that we were no longer counting, when we realize that we were thinking about the argument with a colleague 3 weeks ago, or we don't even know sometimes what we were thinking about. We just know we weren't counting anymore. When we become aware of that, that's the key moment. That's the moment. Because at that moment, we are present. Everything is there. Everything is clear. It lasts about that long. And then something else happens. We say, I was clear. Already we're not anymore. Already we're adding and commenting and judging. And, that was great. I want that again. And then we're gone again. Instead of just counting again. Okay. I lost the count. 1, 2. Just go back to it. And surprisingly, in those moments, just in these few minutes that we did here, even if you did lose the count, you probably were more focused than you were 5 minutes before that, because you had something very specific that you were focusing on. And you didn't have anything else you had to do. There was no other requirements. You didn't have colleagues, children, neighbors, people at the bank, cars. You had nothing to do except sit there and do that. And the distractions were minimal. And even then, with the distractions minimal, you were distracted. Or maybe you weren't, but I was. And even then, we're distracted. So it's not really a realistic situation. It's not. It's a false situation we've created by sitting here. But it's a training situation, and training situations are always false. When you practice a sport, for example, you know, when what's the football team here? FC Porto, right? When they are, you know, on a Thursday afternoon at their training ground, it's not at all like a semi-final in the Champions League. Not the same at all. And the same with this. So we're sitting here, and this is like on the training ground. And then you go out there, and that's the Champions League out there. And that's something else, right? But what you do here serves you there, even though it's not the same. It's not the same, and it is the same. The numerator is different, but the denominator is the same. Any questions or comments about that, or about anything? I should have asked at the beginning, why did you come here? To know more how to address the subject, because it's always different according to the group. Every individual receives a different teaching, and so I should have asked in the beginning, and I didn't. Here's the moment if you want to say, well, you know, I really want peace of mind, or someone told me meditation is good for calming, or I want freedom, or is it true that Zen, that you have to be vegetarian, or I don't know, you know, if you have whatever questions you might have.
Why you say that it is a false situation here?
Well, because we are all, no one is mean to each other here. We have no expectations of one another. People have expectations on me, but apart from that, you know, you're just peacefully here. You don't have to really do anything. No one is demanding anything of you. I gave you this exercise, but you didn't have to do it. No one cares if you do it or not. There's no pressures in that sense of the daily life. We're not in a hurry. None of our children are screaming, or you know, we're not trying to get dinner ready and answer the telephone. It's something apart. Let's say. It's not false in the sense that we're making believe, but it's not the same as when we are out there. False was not a good word.
Yes.
No. Thank you. It's not a good word. No. It's not the same as being out there. And yet, that is our dualistic mind that is making that difference. Because as I said, there is no out there and in here. There's just this wall that we have put up here that separates us from it. We put that wall there. There is no difference between there and here. Of course there are differences. That's right. You look out there and you see a world of differences. But this wall is, we think of it as a separation, but it's not. It's part of what is here. So you're right. It's not false. It's not false at all. Thank you for saying that.
I wanted to come here because I became somehow intrigued about the title of the talk, Zen and the Art of Freedom. And yes, it's the 25th of April, and I think I have some concept of freedom. that is more politically branded than the concept of individual freedom, or I think I see individual freedom as something that is collective. And I became somehow curious about the inclusion of the word the art of freedom. How does freedom become an art? Or is it possible that freedom individually or collectively become a heart or a way of living? And is that is there any difference between those both concepts, art and the way of living? And if life can become itself a form of art?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was what my answer was going to be to. Yes. Absolutely. There is an art of living, and life is art, actually. Art in the sense of creativity. And everyone is innately creative. We don't let it, we don't express it generally because we are limiting ourselves. In terms of the collective and the individual freedom and political freedom and all these things, I'm not talking about political freedom. However, a good example of it is the Dalai Lama and the way that he approaches the struggle of Tibet for freedom. The Dalai Lama's first priority is his practice. He's a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner, and he's one of the highest officials in that structure. And that is his first priority, freeing himself. And if he were not free himself, he would not be able to do what he does. The way that he functions in his dealings with the Chinese, in dealing with world leaders, his just his presence in the world, is a direct result of his work, his practice, in his own freedom. Meaning that he is not limited by fixed ideas about what freedom is, about what Tibet is, what China is, what oppression is, and his teaching is that, and his people who follow him, who have been taken into Chinese jails, for example, have been tortured in Chinese jails, monks in Tibet, when they have escaped or been released and have come to the West and have spoken, and people say to them, "How did you survive?" The strange thing is they said they survived by having compassion for the one who was torturing them. This is a result of their practice of individual freedom. Because they have realized their true nature, they have realized the oneness of all beings and the difference. Nothing can hurt them. And they can see that someone who tries to hurt them is suffering. No one would hurt someone else if they weren't hurt themselves. We would not inflict pain on someone else if we were feeling good about ourselves, we wouldn't inflict pain on another. And so they had compassion for their torturers. This is part of the Dalai Lama's experience and the way that he functions in the world. He famously said in early on after he had left Tibet that even Mao, who was doing terrible things to his country, someone asked him, does everyone have the same nature? And can everyone realize it? Can everyone be awakened, or whatever you want to call it, enlightened, or which just means seeing who they really are. Seeing this common denominator. He was asked if everyone could see that, had the potential to realize that. And he said, yes. And someone said, even Mao? And he said, yes, even Mao. He has absolute confidence that everyone has that potential. I do as well. I'm using him as an example, though, because he's also a political figure, and he's dealing with a political issue of freedom. His relationship with the Chinese is coming from that experience. And he doesn't condemn them. He doesn't... It's very interesting to hear what he says, because it's unlike any other world leader. He's even, you know, his position now is even, well, Tibet doesn't have to be an independent state. Just allow them to live freely. It's okay. They don't need to, it's okay if you want to call it part of China, that's fine, but let them live freely and practice their religion, live among themselves, have their language, have their culture. It's okay. And they won't threaten anyone. He says, we don't even need an army. We won't threaten anyone. His approach to freedom is coming from this practice that I'm telling you about. And he, until now, has held also the political position in his government, but he just recently resigned from that. For political reasons. He's very astute. I say political, it's also spiritual. It's that no one can limit, there are no limits to this experience of freedom. And if he were to take upon himself a limited post, an elected post, a post that is named by some other official, then he becomes, he limits his freedom. And he didn't want to. He saw that he was much, a lot of people regret that he left that position, but he saw that he was much more useful in maintaining the basic practice of individual freedom and the general stance, therefore, of the Tibetan freedom movement. If, you know, another thing that the Dalai Lama says is that, and it's absolutely true, in order for there to be disarmament in the world, first, we have to disarm ourselves. So, everyone has to put down their gun. Their gun being their the aggression with which they approach the world and themselves. Because the gun is usually turned on ourselves. So, I don't know if that answers your question.
It opens a lot.
What?
It opens lots of new questions.
Yeah. Okay, that's good, actually. I'm glad. The questions are much more alive than the answers, in fact. And I say often that all I do is teach people how to question. I can't really do anything else. So I just tell you, I just teach you how to question. What is it right now? What is this moment? Who are you? Actually, the big question is, who are you? Who are you? Or what are you? And you have many ideas. My name, my age, my nationality, my position, my job, my history, my story, my problems, my awards, my successes, my failures, my school, my children, a lot of things. But that's not who you are. Sometimes we say that this practice is just about becoming naked, meaning that we accept to take off our makeup, take off our jewels, take off our disguises, take off our ideas about who we are, who we are not, and just be. And it's not easy. It sounds very simple, but it's not. It's hard. And it's a radical practice, particularly in the culture in which we live, which is directing us to do the opposite. To become someone else, to look different, to look according to a specific model, to dress a certain way, to have a certain kind of job. And therefore, because we have to have all of that, then we have to study certain things. And therefore, we have to live in a certain neighborhood so we can go to the right school. And we have our parents have to have a certain kind of job so that we can go to that right school and live in that neighborhood. And it's endless. And a practice like this is radical. It doesn't mean my life looks like everyone else's, basically. But my life is this, and this is my life. Meaning, everything I do out there is part of this practice. I go to my job, it's my practice. I work as a journalist. That's part of my Zen practice. My colleagues don't know that. They don't practice Zen. I cook dinner for my family. That's my practice. At that moment, that's my practice. Whatever is before me is my practice. My practice of awakening. Whatever it is. So even though I say it's a radical practice, it's not. It's just doing what you have to do. Just doing what there is. Just being who you are. It's radical because we're living in a place where the windows are dark and everyone is telling you something else. So, once the windows have been cleared, you in fact see that there were no windows. There were no walls. And then you just get on with your life. Freely. And life becomes art. Creative. Okay. I might just mention that there, I come and visit Portugal every few months, and there are people who join in our activities and also regularly have a group, a meditation group here in Porto. Saturdays, yeah, every Saturday. If you're interested in learning more about sitting or just sitting with other people. If you want to try it on your own, just do what I showed you to do and see what happens. If you do it on your own, I would recommend some sort of regularity. So 5 minutes, like we did once or twice a week, but at a specific time, So give yourself a little structure. It helps. Mm-hmm. So if you decide you want to do it, you say, okay, I will do it every Monday night at 7 o'clock or something. Or I will do it before I go to work on Wednesdays. Or I'll do it Saturday afternoon because I have some time. You make it something possible, not something that you're not going to do because it's not possible. And then have a specific place in your home where you do it. And say 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever you want to do. And stick to that. No more, no less. If you want to do more after that, then start another contract with yourself and say, okay, I will do 5 more minutes, but no more, no less. The structure is very helpful. That's why it helps to have other people that you do it with in a group, because no one would go on and sit probably and meditate on Saturday if they didn't have that group. None of us would be sitting here tonight talking about this if we didn't have this support, the structure, the time and the place. We would be sitting in a restaurant by the river having fish. So, any questions or comments? Okay. Good, thank you.